Well, greetings. Welcome to The Dividing Line on a cold, it's not all that cold outside. For us, it's pretty cool, but windy, rainy here in Phoenix, and as you don't have to go very far up the street, I-17, and it turns to snow. Northern Arizona just getting pounded today, so that's pretty cool. I wish I had done this like before Christmas. Now that it's February, it's like whatever. But here we are on the program today. A few programming notes. Probably going to take some phone calls today. The reason being, I was not able to get the Sam Alberry audio edited yet. I've started, but I haven't finished it. Sam takes long breaks. I was actually looking at the thing. Well, here, just a second. Let me. Can you see that? This is what Audio Note Taker looks like. And you can see these blocks are portions of audio. And so it's a great program. If you do what I do on this program, this is like absolutely indispensable. Let's see, Anderson, chapter two. Okay. So there's what it looked like when I responded to Steven Anderson, his review of chapter two. So I can pick any section here that I've outlined and just go down here, for example, to this sort of pink section, and then I can.
So we've got an English King James that says the same exact thing,
or stop it, or jump back to the beginning, or whatever. It's a great program. I don't get any money for this, but I don't even know who made it. But this is Audio Note Taker. But notice, see how. The few spaces there are here. Now look at that. Look at this huge amount of spaces. Those are, and then right here is where they ran a big spot of advertising. So it's somebody else talking. And then when you go back to Sam, it goes back to these big, long spaces. He's English. And I've noticed that a lot of English folks are that, Justin Brierley wouldn't be. He can't be. You can't have dead air on when you're a radio dude. Anyways, you can take that down. So it takes a while to edit. And when I say editing, all I'm doing is listening and marking those blocks so that I can go to what really needs to be addressed instead of just listening to the whole thing. And you might say, well, have your staff do that. That's where the rich can is supposed to go up, and you're supposed to go. Oh, and notice, we're having to use the nighttime, night vision, because I'm not allowing Rich to have lights now, and it's cold as well, so he can't get out of there. We're just trying to keep the story going here. The thing about Munster and the cages and stuff, I sort of take it sort of literally, and so that's what we do with the help around here. But I don't have a staff to do this. I do that all myself. I guess my staff are the folks on Twitter that send me links. But when it comes to downloading the file, importing, editing, all that stuff, it'd be nice to have folks do that kind of stuff. I know a lot of other people who do webcasts and stuff that have folks to do that. I'm just not one of them. So it takes some time. So I'll try to get to it for the first program next week. And I think next week we're going to have to do a little shifting because I think I leave Thursday. Yeah, I leave Thursday for the Trinity Conference in Virginia. And so we'll probably have to do a Monday, Wednesday type thing, or maybe Monday, Tuesday. I don't know. It depends on the weather. I'd like to get at least one 85 miler in sometime next week because I'm going to be off bike those days. Anyways, and so we'll try to get it next week if we possibly can. My apologies for that. But what is really fascinating to me is a story that I caught yesterday, and it caught Albert Mueller's attention as well. And that was the Martina Navratilova story. The intersectionality is it is an ever dividing and divisive concept. It can never, it can't stop. Once you think you've reached maximum intersectional points, somebody will come along and beat you at it and call you out and have you attacked. When I posted this, I said, maybe we should just stand back, be faithful to our callings, and let the left just eat itself alive. You know, you got the Smollett, what's the guy's name? Yeah, I don't know. I've never seen that television program, never heard of that television program. The first time I ever heard of this guy was when this attack took place. And of course, we all know it was fraud now. And it's just fascinating watching the people on the left. Well, you know, we hope he gets help. It's just the hypocrisy. The left has no problem with hypocrisy. They have no standards to violate to be hypocrites in the first place. So it's just stunning. And I haven't seen the Christian social justice warriors that were up in arms, coming back and saying, oh, well, okay, maybe. And instead, it's like, well, there's still plenty of this going on, and it's now this is just going to, you know, you're just going to use it to dismiss everything. And so it's like, okay, well, whatever. Anyway, the Martina story, because I, you know, she's not, I wonder how old she is. Someone look up how old Martina Navratilova is. Just Google her real fast. Because I think if she's older than me, she's not much older than me. 62? Okay, all right, 6 years older than me. So, you know, I played tennis in high school and was pretty good. I went to state as a sophomore. I didn't play my junior and senior years when I could have done better. I was so involved at North Phoenix Baptist Church, to be perfectly honest with you. My coach was very angry about that I was more interested in church stuff than playing on the tennis team. But I've always had some interest. Michael Fallon was a tennis pro, and he knew a lot of these folks. And so I got inside stories from him about this, that, and the other thing. And so I've had an interest in that particular area. And I'm old enough to remember the Chrissy Evert, Martina Navratilova epic matches and stuff. And Chrissy Evert was a class act. I mean, she was a beautiful lady. But she herself and Martina Navratilova both would admit with pure honesty that they could not compete with the top 100 men in the tennis tour. And there's a reason for this. And it's because there's a difference between men and women. Men are stronger than women. They're taller. They can serve. I mean, just watch even the biggest, strongest women. I won't go any farther than that. The biggest, strongest women still cannot compete with the best men. It's a physical impossibility. The physics just aren't there. It's just so obvious. So, what's fascinating, is to see Martina back in December tweeted something and basically called men who pretend to be women to compete with women cheaters. Now, go back. You don't even have to go back 20 years. You could really literally only go back 5 years and the vast majority of people would be going, yeah, duh. 10 years, definitely. You know, 5 years, it's starting to change. But with Obergefell, there it goes. It just right out the window. Oh, the pushback she gets. Because everybody, again, I'm assuming you know, Martina Navratilova came out long, long ago as a lesbian. I've pointed out over and over again, there is no LGBTQ community because there is no consistency between LGBTQRSTUV. They are contradictory concepts. And what's being pointed out here is that for the L's, the T's are, it's, this is what's going on. Because you can't have L and G if you don't have male and female. But T says there is no male and female. So the only thing that holds any of this together is we hate God's law. And you can't create a community out of that. I'm sorry. It's a total negative thing. And so there's nothing positive to hold this community together other than your common hatred of God's law and how you're supposed to live. So to honor him, reflect him, and to flourish yourself. So she puts out this tweet. Man, she gets attacked. And what's fascinating is she goes back. She says, I wonder if I'm wrong. She does a bunch of reading and comes back out in an interview a few days ago and says, I've done my research and all it has done is confirmed me even more strongly that if you are a biological male, if you were a functioning, non-surgically and chemically altered male up into puberty, that's it. It doesn't matter if you start taking hormones after anything. Your bone structure, your sinews, your muscles, your arterial system, the very makeup of your blood itself has been for the rest of your life permanently determined by your sex, whether you're a male or a female. And the male, because of primarily testosterone, but then there are secondary results because of that, the male's going to have an advantage. Even if you cut back testosterone later in life, you've still got stronger, thicker muscles. You've got stronger connections, bones. That's just the way it is. And so she just stands up on the basis of fact and says, this is the way it is. You're cheating. And she has been removed from her positions of representative here and taken off this board over there and all this kind of stuff, which is exactly what you would expect of totalitarian leftists. They will eat their own. They will eat anybody. Because, as I said on Twitter, totalitarians, totalitarian. That's what they do. That's their nature. And our culture is dumb enough to elect them to office. Hey, isn't it great, folks, that that Bernie Sanders is running for president? could you find out for me, how old is Bernie Sanders? I'd like to know how old Bernie Sanders is, because I've been seeing a lot of pretty funny memes on Facebook and Twitter about a toothless Bernie. Did you get something?
Bernie is 77.
77.
So did you hear what Tucker Carlson said the other day?
So if he's 77 now, then he'd be 78 or 9, depending on where his birthday is,
the
election.
Sure 9. At least 9.
Yeah. I did not hear what Tucker... I listened to Tucker Carlson.
He made the point that he's convinced that Bernie Sanders uses a balloon to comb his hair.
A balloon... Yep. Did you see the meme where it's Bernie Sanders with Vice President Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? Which, of course, can't happen because she's actually not old enough to run for that office. And it says, make us Venezuela. Yeah, that's exactly what it's all about. Yeah. Well, anyway, we keep electing these folks, and they keep bowing down to this agenda. And all you got to do is look at it and realize, wow, what a mess this is. Intersectionality, concepts of oppression, and all this non-biblically defined. And I know there's all sorts of Christians that say, well, the Bible teaches this, and then you try to really pin them down on exegesis, and what they're really doing is they're saying, well, I can read the Bible, the Sojourners, for example, I can read the Bible in a way that's consistent with socialistic concepts. I can read the Bible as if the biblical concept of justice is economic equality, that everyone has the same amount. Now, that's never happened on Earth. It will never happen on Earth. It can't happen on Earth. It's been promised over and over again, and every time it fails, because if you have a biblical anthropology, then you go, oh, yeah, that's really going to work. Yeah, we can trust the government people to always make sure that everybody has the same right. It's so naive that it's just like, really? Do you sell used cars or just what? I mean, honestly. But there will be people who will say, well, you know, biblically, justice is everybody having the same, you know, having economic equality with one another. When the scriptures never teach that. The scriptures teach that those who are rich are not to oppress the poor, but the scriptures also teach that in the court of law, you are not to give any extra credit to the poor over the rich or vice versa. This idea that biblically socialism, communism, this is what it was all about, is only able to be substantiated by people who do not believe that you have to interpret the Bible as a whole, that you have to allow the Bible as a whole to speak. They have to just take one little thing here, one little thing there, practice their eisegesis, and that's how to do it. That's what Sojourners is all about. That's what the left is all about. And unfortunately, that's what you're now going to have coming to your local Baptist church. Because what we are seeing is, what we're seeing is the final fruit of the dumbing down and denigration of the public educational system, and hence the thought processes of the voting public within the United States. It's taken a long time, but they've been patient and they've managed to do it. There was a day when education involved teaching people how to think, not what to think. And to teach people how to think meant challenging them to think critically. And what that means was to examine foundational presuppositions in an argument, to examine arguments as to whether they're based upon factuality, probabilities, the whole concept of logic. Yes, logic. The proper forms of argumentation. What is wrong with ad hominem argumentation? What is wrong with the excluded middle, and what the law of non-contradiction is, and modus ponens and modus tollens, and all the different aspects of symbolic logic and things, used to be something that you could expect at least of a freshman in college. Now, literacy itself is not something you can necessarily expect of a freshman in college. And as a result, people who have not been taught to think in a critical fashion. And by the way, if you read the Bible and you read it well, the Bible will teach you critical thought. Yeah, it will. You will not be able to make heads or tails out of the Bible if you do not apply meaningful categories of interpretation to be able to follow the story, to be able to if you look at how the New Testament understands the Old Testament and makes application, this requires critical thought. This requires you to do something more than just go, yeah, while you're wearing your headphones listening to some type of music or something like that. You actually have to take the headphones off and get into some place that's quiet. This freaks out most millennials and people younger than them. Get into a place that is quiet and ponder and meditate and think, and you will learn critical thinking skills. And since that has pretty much been abandoned in the younger generations, they are easily manipulated. And we are seeing this in the Southern Baptist Convention right now. We're seeing this in the Southern Baptist Convention right now. And not just in the SBC. Let me mention this before I lose this, and I'll come back to the SBC. Remember how long ago? It was only 6 months ago or so that Jeff and I had the little debate with our Mormon friend from Utah. It was about 6 months or so ago, something like that. And I was taken aback to discover that later on, this young man was the head of the campus Democrats at BYU. He and I had this brief conversation before we got started with the program, and I was taken aback with just how leftist his perspectives were, because that's not the history of Mormonism in Utah. And it took me back. Were you there for the conversation with the fellow at the South Gate sometime toward the end of our tenure there, somewhere around 2000, late 90s. What was the last time I was there? 04? I forget. Somewhere around there before the King James Only guys ruined everything. And I remember so clearly, because I remember talking about it with somebody when we went up to over the LDS Book and Supply, and I was buying a new triple or something like that. And I remember I was still thinking about what this guy had said. But he had stood at the South Gate and he had pointed up. You remembering this? I've told the story, so maybe you weren't there. Okay. He's pointing up at the spire, at the temple. And he says, in 20 years, there will be a cross on top of that spire. And I was like, you know, because back then, still, the vast majority of Mormons, if I had had a cross, I didn't wear my crosses. I love wearing my cross. By the way, it's when Roman Catholic goes, look, it's a beaded thing. Maybe he's become Roman. It's Navajo. I happen to love Navajo stuff. I love turquoise and coral and onyx and in sterling silver. When I drive up to, one of the things I love doing when I drive up to Utah is there's, when you go through the reservation, there's all sorts of places you can just pull off. And man, those folks make some beautiful stuff. And so I've got some beautiful Indian crosses and stuff. They're just, I've got that one little one that they made out of this, like, what is that stuff called? It glows orange. I mean, it just, when it catches any light at all, it's just, wah. And I got that on the reservation. You know, I pulled over one day and I said, whoa, got to get that. So that's what those things are, by the way, just for the Romanists who are going, oh, it's a beaded rose. It's Navajo. Hello. Anyway, how'd I get onto that? The cross thing. Oh, yeah. If I was back then, if I had a cross on my thing or something like that, You'd still get, remember the young missionaries that would come up to us and they would say, well, if your son was stabbed to death, would you wear a knife around your neck? Type of a thing. And so to have a Mormon go 20 years from now, there's going to be a cross up there. This guy was he was ahead of the curve. He was seeing stuff from the inside that we weren't seeing yet. He was seeing the changes. What does all this have to do with where we are right now? Article, will Utah be the 16th state to ban conversion therapy for gay teens? And the Mormon Church has come out and said, we will not stand against this. Mormonism has become a jellyfish. There's, And when you think about it, it makes sense with all the years when we've had to deal with the Mormon testimony and the subjective feelings and all the rest of that stuff. But still back then, they still had a core that said Joseph Smith really experienced these things and he really had the first vision and we're really the one true church. Now that that's even been sort of abandoned and put off to the side, what's left? There's no skeleton. It's like that one guy in that one X-Men thing where he gets exposed to some that radiation stuff and turns into a blob of Clementine is calling me right now on FaceTime. Here, I won't be able to put it on. Clementine, I'm doing the dividing line right now, and you're on the dividing line. Here, everybody, there, say hi to Clementine. Say hi to everybody, Clementine.
Hi.
You're on the dividing line right now. Isn't that cool?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Do you remember when do you remember when you were on the dividing line when you were like two? Probably don't remember that, do you? No. No, you came in here and you sat right here. And before you came in, I picked you up and I put me on you on my lap. And you go, shoes off, because you still had your shoes on. You didn't think you're supposed to have your shoes on. So you go, shoes off. That's all you said. So. We're recording right now. You'll be able to watch this when we. It's live. Right? It's live right now. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Daddy's watching.
Yeah. There's. Say hi, Katie.
Hi.
There's. Oh, camera is being used by another application. Okay. Well, anyways, guys, I'll have to talk to you later. Thank you for joining me on the program today. We'll see ya. Bye. Hey, I'm a grandfather and my grandkids called. There you go. And there's Eric going, whoops, I guess I should watch her. that's okay. So there you go. Clementine just made a guest appearance on the dividing line via FaceTime. So that was fun. But she did not remember that. You remember that, don't you? So picked her up and that was only like 4 years ago. now I'm watching Summer's traveling to a women's retreat. And so she's going, what's going on? And Eric's going, Clementine just FaceTimed into the dividing lines. technology. It's a wonderful thing. Anyways, so, but now Jenny and Waylon are going to be upset. They didn't get to be on the dividing like Katie and Clementine did. But, I was watching them today. They had snow in the backyard. And so for Jenny, that was the first time she'd ever seen this stuff. What is this stuff falling out of the sky? They're desert rats. And I saw a video of Jenny throwing a little snowball at Katie. And either Cadence, I think, must be growing because she looked like a giant in comparison to Jenny. So it was funny. But anyway, so there you go, folks. A little bit. Who was it yesterday that was saying that I'm probably a real bleep to my family, and that I've never changed a diaper, and you know, some lovely woman on Twitter or Facebook. Yeah, it was real sweet. My grandkids could correct their misapprehensions, but oh well, we won't go there. Okay, what were we saying? Did you have something you wanted to add to help me remember where I was?
Well, I actually haven't lost track of that particular what led up to last summer's interview that you guys did with him, where there was the
interview I did with who?
Kwaku.
Oh, yes.
And the program that they did just before he came down here with the one guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know what went through my mind at the time was, wow, this is our Dennis Potter's dream world.
Yep.
It has come to, if any of you have watched the debate with Dennis Potter,
yep.
He was and became an even more interesting fellow.
Well, became an even more interesting non-fellow.
Non-fellow, yeah. Well, he's still, anyway.
Yeah, I know.
But you get the idea, is that this was already happening back in the early 2000s.
Yeah, and we just didn't see it. It's not the first thing we would think about, you know? I mean, this ain't normal thinking. Anyways, my point is, Mormonism has not only lost its way, but it has no moral compass any longer. And so here you have Utah, 16 state to ban conversion therapy for gay teens? Question mark. It hasn't happened yet, but it probably will. Now, we could stop here and talk a lot about Mormon anthropology, which is grossly unbiblical. If you have such a grossly unbiblical view of God that you're a polytheist and think God's the only man living on another planet, then you're going to have a grossly unbiblical anthropology, and hence no basis whatsoever to offer up any meaningful resistance to the moral revolution that we are facing today in our society. And Mormonism is just going along. It will be the end of the Mormon church, because once you start, I mean, can there be anything more obviously central to the Mormon doctrine of God than gender? I mean, Mormonism is about a patriarchal system as you can possibly have. I mean, God the Father has a body of flesh and bones with which he can have sex with the Virgin Mary. He is a male. He has male genitalia. So how can, once Mormonism can start spiritualizing that away, it's the end of Mormonism. I mean, it will end up going the way of all the leftist, liberal, Protestant denominations. And obviously, at some point, it's going to shatter. Because I don't see, it's possible, maybe it'll just die with a whimper. But in most situations, at some point, those folks down around Manti are going to say, enough of that. And they're going to bolt. So, yeah. So that takes me back to the Southern Baptists. The Houston Chronicle story that we mentioned last week about sex abuse, the Southern Baptist Me Too moment. First of all, do y'all remember right after I got back from Munster that I played portions of J.D. Greer's sermon and interacted with it? Y'all remember what he said during that? I didn't cue it up. I could have, but I didn't, because I'm not trying to rub it in. But remember when he said, he quoted a lady from their church who does teaching there? Don't tell me that complementarianism is on the decline amongst Southern Baptists. It's about dead. Egalitarianism is winning by default. Where he quoted her saying, when the Bible talks about sexual sins, it whispers. As I said on Facebook this morning, that sermon hasn't aged well, has it? Given that it's only a month and a half old. Looking at this situation, again, let me just repeat what we started saying last year. The social justice train is a train, and the engine is followed by the boxcars, and the boxcars are containing a bunch of stuff. And on the outside, all it says is the beauty of justice. But on the inside, you've got everything. You've got egalitarianism. You've got basically the idea is we have a crisis. Now, the crisis may be a real crisis. It may be a manufactured crisis. It could be the actor saying that he's been beat up by people wearing MAGA hats. Or let's go back into ancient history to the Covington, Kentucky Catholic boys. Realize for most people that is ancient history. That is how short our attention span is anymore. Anybody in a MAGA hat, and have you seen the MAGA hats that say make Alexandria go away? That's still MAGA. That's one worth wearing. But the it can be manufactured, it can be real, but what you do, and this is the left's, this is how the left is destroying Western culture, and it's purposeful. It is absolutely purposeful. That doesn't mean everybody on the left has read the books, gotten the memo. It's not some big, huge conspiracy thing. But the people, the George Soroses of the world with their money, this is what they want. They want to fundamentally disunite, take apart, destroy fundamentally at its foundations Western culture. And to do that, you have to go after its Judeo-Christian history and worldview, the relationship of its people and the family, which includes in the family, sexual identity, gender, father, mother, what marriage is. You get rid of those things, there's no Western culture left. And you have anarchy, and then you can bring in a totalitarian system. And there is no question in my mind. Just you explain to me how we've gone from 1980 to 2020. You explain to me. And what you're going to see is this movement. And what? How are they doing it? Create a crisis. It can be a real crisis. It can be a natural disaster. It can be a real humanitarian situation. Or make it up. Whatever it is. And then utilize that in the minds of people who are no longer taught to think logically. They are no longer taught to think long-term. They are no longer taught to think on the basis of presuppositions of a worldview. Convince them it's a crisis. And what do we see around us all the time now? What do we see all the time? We've got to do something now. We've got to do something now. Even if it's the dumbest thing we've ever done, we've got to do something now. And that's how you get action. That's how you get people to do things. And what we're seeing in the SBC is, oh my goodness, look at all these terrible things happening. Look at what happened with Paige Patterson. Look at now the Houston Chronicle story. Look at this, look at that. And so what we're going to do is we're going to make fundamental changes. And we're going to create, and it's not going to be, we're going to stop and pray and focus ever more upon biblical categories, holiness in the church, accountability. We're not going to look at our decades-long mistake of letting people think that they call themselves to the ministry. We're not going to look at our ecclesiology and recognize the New Testament actually teaches a plurality of elders and not a single pastor with deacons pretending they're elders. We're not going to, none of that stuff. No. Let's not go there. Let's not have a regenerate church membership. Let's not prune our roles so that you only have people who are actually coming that you can actually observe and pastor and so on. No. We won't do anything like that. Instead, let's totally change our approach and start creating all these extra biblical categories and authorities and registries and let's elect a woman as the president of the Southern Baptist Convention while we're at it, and let's go ahead and give in on the complementary and egalitarian thing, and let's just buy the whole cultural contextualization of the texts and all that stuff about creation mandate and the role of man, and let's not worry about any of that kind of stuff at all, and let's just go with the culture. And what you're seeing, there are people standing up to it, but what you're seeing is if it's left unchecked, we'll put the SBC right back where it was in the 1970s. The entire quote unquote conservative resurgence will be done away with. And you'll be right back. Southern Seminary will be right back to where it was before Mueller, if it's not checked. And so there's one other thing I wanted to get to, and then let's go ahead and open the phones at 877-753-3341, 877-753-3341 is the phone number. 877-753-3341. Which leads me to another issue. Much of what I just mentioned was brought out in an article that on Facebook or Twitter, maybe both, I thought it was just one. On the last program, I mentioned very briefly, it didn't take much time, but I mentioned with some level of humor the fact that this will surely get me into trouble. But I mentioned that I had referred people to an article on the subject of Al Mohler's apology and the Sovereign Grace stuff that was written by Douglas Wilson. And I sort of did the same eye roll in looking at Rich, and I said, of course, I asked people to set aside their prejudices, their agendas, and just read the article and think about it. People can't do that. People cannot do that. I had a conversation with my daughter yesterday while I was driving back from the East Valley. And we've all seen Trump derangement syndrome. I mean, there are people. Trump could give every dime he possesses to build houses for the poor and stuff like that. It would not matter to these people. They are deranged. There is a complete lack of objectivity. There is a complete lack of logic. It is 1,000% animus and emotion. 0% logical rationality. There is an anti-Doug Wilson derangement syndrome, too. Now, I've seen anti-James White derangement syndrome. I've met people that just, it doesn't matter. There is nothing I could say or do that these people could ever be gracious enough to consider to be anything other than just hatred and arrogance and nastiness. There are people like that. But I can't hold a candle to Doug Wilson on this one. Can't do it. You even mention the name, and it's just like people who otherwise would be willing to listen to you or talk to you, just mention the name, and it's just like, it's like whispering Voldemort. It really is. I've just never seen anything like it, other than Trump derangement syndrome. I've seen it amongst the left in regards to, but amongst Christians. I mean, there was a thread on Facebook, mainly women. I tried to make a comment about it because I had posted this, just a link to a single article. Oh my goodness. The vile vituperation, the running violation of every single biblical mandate as to the control of the tongue. It's from Christians, just vomiting hatred from their mouths. Just how fast can I say I hate Doug Wilson? And how many different ways? It's just like, whoa, unbelievable to watch this. It's stunning. It really, really is. And I asked, just read the article and listen to what it's saying. People can't do that. They just can't. It's stunning. Let me just mention what I found to be important in the article, because I just said all of it. And if you weren't sitting there going, that's terrible, that's horrible, then why are you saying that's terrible, that's horrible, when somebody else says it? Because I'm prejudiced. Well, be honest about it. You know, just be straight up about it. I just don't like that man because of this thing over there, and I think I know everything about that thing. By the way, can I just mention something? People wonder why I would be hesitant to jump into internal church situations from a church I've never been at and haven't been within hundreds of miles of. And that's because I've been an elder in a church for decades. I know that situations very frequently arise. And anybody who's been an elder, that's why I do not understand people who've been in the eldership who do this type of thing. But things arise in the life of the church where when the situation is concluded in the life of the church, discipline's taken place, or it's been chosen discipline's not going to take place, or restoration has taken place, whatever. From that point on, the elder cannot run to Facebook and talk about these things. There are things that you can't talk about. And so if other people run off and start making claims, you just have to go, I can't talk about that. I can't defend myself about that. And so I know there's always not just a second side, but probably a third side and a fourth side, and then there's the tertiary fifth side over there. I recognize the reality of that. And so it's stunning to me how many people who are actually in eldership, in the position of eldership, just will join in with the mob. And that was part of what the issue was. If you just looked at the article, and I realize some of you just wouldn't even do one of the first comments in that Facebook thread was, I'm not going to read the article, but you're an idiot for sharing it. It's just like, wow. Okay. Let me break down, since, you know, if you don't want to read it, let me just break it down. There is a biblical standard of judgment. Two or three witnesses. And mobs are not vehicles for God's justice, even when they are made up of weeping, crying, also sensitive, lovely people who call themselves Christians. It's still a mob. And this is not how biblical justice is to be done. The funny thing is here, was it November was the Kavanaugh hearings? October? Okay, October, November. Not that long ago, many of the very same people who are forming a mob now were all upset because a mob was being formed to go after Judge Kavanaugh. The very same people who once talked about due process, not worried about it now. There has to be some type of consistency. There has to be some level of consistency here. So if you recognize that the left was railroading Justice Kavanaugh, then you can't then just turn that off later on in another situation. The same biblical standards have to apply. Whether you like them or not, whether it makes you popular or not, it doesn't matter. Due process is due process. So here's some of the quotes. In looking at investigations, did it meet the criteria? Was there an opportunity for cross-examination? Boy, we could talk about that on another issue. Was there a presumption of innocence? Was anyone allowed to face their accuser? Was there time allotted for both the prosecution and the defense? Due process is a good thing. Yeah, exactly. And what you need to understand, I keep mentioning this, and I imagine a lot of people are just tired of it, but I can't get out of my mind the Stasi prison in East Germany. Well, it's in Berlin now, but former East Germany, where the totalitarian communist socialist mindset would imprison people for the sole purpose, not to try to protect other people or anything like that, but to break the individual. Their whole purpose. It's 1984 all over. If you've read 1984, this was what happens in 1984. You break the person, you get them to love Big Brother, then you kill them. But you had to break them first, because that's what a totalitarian government's all about. And so the whole issue in the Stasi prison, there was never due process. It was a sham. You could never face your accuser. Didn't need to have an accuser. All those fundamental things of justice, which, by the way, came from the biblical law, done away with. Done away with. We should be the people that are most sensitive to that. But when a mob forms and you buy into the, we've got to do something right now, you can't follow biblical standards of justice at that point. You can't do that. So, someone had said, Voldemort had said, the Southern Baptist Convention is teetering right on the verge of getting sucked down the woke hole. In my view, about the only person with enough throw weight to keep that from happening, and who actually might want to keep that from happening, was Al Mohler. Again, if you didn't read it, you wouldn't notice this, but he said a lot of really positive things about Al Mohler in this article. But evidently, he doesn't get any credit for anything positive he might say about, you know, praying for Al Mohler, and he did that terrible thing 20 years ago, so I just don't care. Was Al Mohler. And I believe that for all intents and purposes, the bad guys have effectively neutralized him. We'll see. It's possible. Later on. But when a horror story happens, here's the what's called reflexivity, okay? But when a horror story happens and someone starts using it as a lever to introduce some systemic changes in line with their agenda, and someone else responds to this proposal for systemic change with a reminder of the broader context, this is fully appropriate and necessary. This goes double when it is obvious that the horror story was broken with an agenda in mind. For example, we've all seen this. If there's a school shooting, and someone tries to comfort us by reminding us how many schools weren't shot up that day, then he is a blockhead. But if there is a school shooting and the first thing that happens is a full court press for gun control, and someone responds with some contextualizing data, that is just what ought to happen. So my point here is not to stand by these numbers as necessarily rock solid. I have my doubts, but it is to insist on equal weights and measures and on the need to compare apples to apples. If we need systemic change on how to deal with sexual predation of children, then, by the way, there was a paragraph, jump paragraphs there. He talked about the sexual abuse of students in the public school system with literally not 700, not 7,000, not 70,000, not 700,000, but millions of students that have been impacted. That's where he was talking about these numbers. If we need systemic change in how to deal with sexual predation of children, then we need to start with the LGBTQ plus grooming in the schools, all the sex ed courses, and the informal labs out behind the gym. Also, it is incidentally to point out that the real scandal is how many Southern Baptists still have their kids in the government school system. I cannot conceive of how, well, first of all, why do people fear reading these words? Because there are people that I won't touch it, I won't read it. Okay. Then you're not going to be challenged to think about the fact that what he's saying is there's more going on here than meets the eye. We are being convinced in the society that each one of these crises is somehow separate from the others. They're not. And the people that are seeking to fundamentally change our society and our churches know that they're not. They're connecting them together. They're using them that way. And we can't defend ourselves because we will not be bothered to see how they're all tied together. That's what he said. What he said was true. If Douglas Wilson says the sky is blue, you don't have to argue that it's actually green. And if you do go that far, I feel sorry for you. I really do. I just don't get this stuff. I don't. But anyhow, like I said, I asked people, set aside your prejudices. And for some people, that is not possible to do. Okay. Let's see. We've got 14 minutes, 27 seconds. But we do have somebody paying money to call long distance, right? All right, so I'll be good to the... Well, I'm not sure if it... You know, long distance used to be a lot different than it is today. Have you noticed that? Long distance, you know, used to be really expensive. Remember, you'd get all those things on your phone bill, and we don't do that anymore. But, there you go. Yeah. Very good. All right. Let's help with the long distance charges, if there are any, and start off with Gregory in the West Indies. Hi, Gregory.
Good day, Dr. White. God bless you.
Yes, sir.
And great to speak to you once more again. No, I'm calling concerning an issue. In the argument between Calvinism and Arminianism, for example, I have heard Dr. Brown use this argument, who is a good dear brother in the Lord Jesus Christ, and thank God for his ministry. He does a lot for the Lord Jesus Christ. But I've heard him in refuting Arminianism when the argument is brought up in concerning John chapter 6, where it is said that God draws his elect and his drawing cannot be resisted. And Dr. Brown would counteract with the argument. And I think the last time I've heard him use that was in his debate with, I think, Hernandez, something like that.
Yes, Sonny Hernandez.
Uh-huh. Some kind of name like that. Yes, Sonny Hernandez. And Sonny Hernandez brought up this argument. I think he's a hyper-Calvinist. But he brought up this argument concerning John chapter 6. And Dr. Brown countered it with, but in the Old Testament, God draws Israel. The Old Testament said God drew Israel, but Israel resisted the drawing of God. And he used that argument against Sonny to show that God's drawing can be resisted, because in the Old Testament, Israel resisted the drawing of God when it said God had drew them.
Right. Right. Well, yeah, mm-hmm. I heard that, and I just asked Michael actually just now when we can reschedule what we were going to try to do right before I headed to Germany and Russia, which was do our atonement discussion here on the program. So we'll probably get that done over the next couple of weeks. Anyway, well, I was obviously disappointed in Dr. Hernandez's arguments, and especially when he's right there in the text that would be such a strong place. Dr. Hernandez, I think, wasted a tremendous amount of time parsing Greek verbs as if that was relevant to the subject, and did not challenge Dr. Brown, as I will have to challenge Dr. Brown, because Michael said, show me any place where the drawing of God automatically results in the salvation of a person. And I'm like, okay, there it is. There's a setup. There's the yes. Tossing of the softball, and then knock it out of the park. And Hernandez wouldn't do it. But I would point out that textually at John 6:44, here's the issue. And I know I've covered it again. You've probably heard it, but let me make sure everybody is understanding what's being said here. In John 6:44, after and I always hesitate a little bit to talk about 6:44 without having established the context back to at least verse 37 with the assertion, all the Father gives me will come to me, the one coming to me I will never cast out. The Son's come down of heaven to do the will of the Father, and Father's will that he gives him, he loses none of them. It's all sovereignty of God, power of God, perfect unity of the Father and the Son and salvation, centrality of Jesus, all the rest of that stuff, which results then in the grumbling of the Jews. You know, who does this man think he is? And Jesus' response to them is, no one is able to come to me except the Father, the one who sent me, draws him, and I will raise him up on the last day. So when we see that phrase, unless the Father who sent me draws him, what happens is, as you just enunciated, the Arminian will say, yeah, but God draws all sorts of people. He drew the Israelites in the Old Testament, or John 12:32 says, if I be lifted up, I'll draw all men unto myself. And so drawing is just a prevenient grace type thing. It's it is an extent, we have to have God's grace, but God's grace just simply brings us to a position of like moral neutrality, or someplace where we can accept Jesus, or concepts like this. And what I have emphasized over and over again is that requires you to shoehorn, to insert an entire theology into John 6:44 between the words auton and kago. So you have the one who sent me draws him, and I, kago is a crassus of kai and ago, and I will raise him on the last day. So what is necessary, and what I'll challenge Michael on this, and I say this publicly because when Michael and I are talking, we're not trying to catch each other up. We're not trying to trick each other. We're actually trying to get somewhere in a discussion. The first auton, unless I draw him, and I will raise him, kago anastasia auton, the second auton, in Arminian theology, those are two different hymns, because in between, and there's only two words between the two autons, but somewhere in there is an entire theology of free will, autonomous creaturely will, prevenient grace, and all the rest of stuff. And I can't find it. I've looked at a lot of different manuscripts. I've never found it there, but that's the Arminian position, is that the first hymn is everybody and the second hymn is the person it chooses. Whereas anyone simply reading the text and not inserting anything there would have to come to the conclusion that the autons are identical. And in fact, on any grammatical level, using the crassus kago anastaso, and I will raise him up on the last day, I could make a strong argument that they would have to be identical to one another. There's no way to split them up. And so what that means is whoever is drawn by the Father is raised up by the Son. Now, you could argue that being raised up on the last day doesn't necessarily mean to salvation, but in this context, it does. Because Jesus has said, all the Father gives me, I will raise them up on the last day. That's being raised up to eternal life. So this is salvation. And so what 6:44 does say, it fulfills the exact challenge that Michael made to Sonny Hernandez. Show me a place where everyone who is drawn is necessarily saved. Well, it's John 6:44, because no one has the ability to come to the Son unless they're drawn. And if they are drawn by the Father, they will be raised up by the Son unto eternal life. So if everybody's drawn, then this is universalism. Everybody will be raised up to eternal life. Otherwise, it's Reformed theology. Those that are drawn by the Father are the elect. Those are the ones that are raised up by Jesus. And then that's proven by 6:45. Because not everybody is taught by God. Not everyone learns from God. But everyone who hears from the Father and is learning from him comes to Jesus. That's the effect of the drawing in our own experience, in our own life. So I was disappointed because I was frustrated extremely at that point when, here you've got this opportunity, and instead we got a first-year Greek lesson that didn't communicate anything at all. It was terrible.
Yes, but thank you very much for the expression. Well, the call keep on going out, and in, so I'm going to listen to the program to get straight what you said, because the call keep on going out and in.
All right, thank you.
Can I say something else?
Yes.
So basically, the drawing in the Old Testament of Israel is a different drawing to the elect in John chapter 6.
Yeah, to try to connect the two contexts of the mm-hmm. patient prophetic ministration of prophets and so on and so forth with Israel in the Old Testament is to make the confusion between the Old Covenant and New Covenant. There's a difference between the two covenants. And in the New Covenant, everybody from the least to the greatest of them knows him. Whereas in the old covenant, you had a mixed covenant. So the drawing would be different. The effect of the drawing, the purpose of the drawing, it'd all be different. Jesus doesn't make that connection in John 6. So that would be bringing in a foreign context.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Gregory.
May God bless both you and Dr. Brown and your ministry.
All right, God bless you all. God bless. Thanks. All right. Bye-bye. All right. We'll probably just take these next three. And they're all right at about the same one here. So, don't have any idea what this means, but let's talk to Emery in Kentucky. Hi, Emery.
Hi, Dr. Wade. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
And I blessed the last year. I had to Midlandsboro. Hopefully time though.
Are you on a speakerphone?
No, sir. I'm on a Bluetooth, but I am driving, and I got a big old van that's quite loud. Would you like me to try to switch to my phone?
I don't know. I'm only getting about 60% of what you're saying, so I'm going to have to guess at what your question is.
Can you hear me better now, sir?
Yes, I can.
Oh, excellent. My question is in relation to the cult, World Church of God. I think they're from Korea. And we were meeting with me and a friend of mine were meeting with this guy, and we figured, you know, we'll ask him, okay, so what is the gospel? And he started off by going to Mark and saying, well, the gospel is the person and work of Christ. And Christ said that, you know, you had to be baptized. So baptism is an integral part of the gospel. And then he went on to say, and we need to keep these feast days. So you can't be saved unless you're keeping these feasts and you're worshiping on Saturday, on the Sabbath. And he tied that back to, of course, the first fourth commandment. So my question was, as it relates to the fourth commandment, we kind of got sidetracked on that, but I thought it was a interesting challenge because I'd never been challenged on why do we worship on Sunday as opposed to Saturday, and how would that tie into the Mosaic Law?
I didn't catch the last part. Tie into what?
The giving of the Mosaic Law, the Ten Commandments.
Oh, my. Okay, well, fundamentally, the answer to that's going to be found in understanding the concept of Kyrie Kehemera, the Lord's Day, in regards to the early church's gathering on the Lord's Day, the day of the Lord's resurrection, which was after the Sabbath. And then, of course, you get the extended argument made by some strongly within the Reformed community that there is a wholesale transfer of old covenant concepts of Sabbath to the new Christian Sabbath, which becomes the Lord's Day in light of the resurrection. And that is much more of a concept that is developed in the 1600s. And I personally don't know of any patristic viewpoint on that. I think that is much more of a modern concept, but it's generally argued out of Hebrews chapter 4 and the Sabbath rest material that is found in that particular chapter. I've always said that, especially when it comes to apologetics and dealing with people who are trying to enforce a salvific Sabbatarianism, in essence, it sounds like what this person is attempting to do, it's going to be very complicating to try to engage that from the Puritan perspective. The more continental view, I think, is a little bit easier to defend on a exegetical basis, and that is a focus upon Revelation chapter 1, the use of that phrase, Kyrie Kehemera. You also find it in Paul. Kyrie Kehemera simply means the Lord's Day. And it's pretty easy to establish between the New Testament and then the earliest patristic documents that the Kyrie Kehemera was on Sunday. And so John was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day and so on and so forth. And that it was not an attempt to transfer the Sabbath as a whole, as it functioned under the Old Covenant, into the New Covenant with the same strictures. Instead, the resurrection is such a history-changing reality that the church gathers on that day because she always lives in the light of the resurrection and hence commemorates that in her worship of a risen Lord, not just one who is prophesied from the Old Covenant, but now has truly risen from the dead and is in his church and is building his body, the church. It almost sounds like the only way this guy could make the type of arguments that he's making is does he in some way have a modified canon or at least a minimalization of Paul or something? It sounded like it.
Well, I'm not so sure about that, but I do know that they believe that Christ came back in the 40s and was from South Korea, and there was also the Holy Spirit who came back as a man.
Oh, Unification Church?
Their website is World Church Mission, or World Mission Church of God, I believe.
Yeah, that almost sounds like a...
with the Mother God.
That sounds like a split off from the Moonies, the Unification Church or something. But I can't keep up with all the plethora of Korean, Asian cult groups. There are a lot of them out there.
Certainly.
I used to try to keep up with some of those things, but it's sort of hard to today.
Mm.
Yeah. So
if back to the question, it sounds like obviously, I guess from the apostolic example we were meeting on Sunday, how does that then tie in with, you said, you know, not necessarily a full bringing over of the Old Covenant Sabbath to Sunday? How do we tie that together? I'm kind of wondering.
Well, again, amongst Reformed folks, I want to just refer you to, you know, there are entire presentations by really sharp folks, normally based on Hebrews 4, that will give you the best argument that you can get for the transferal in toto of the Sabbath to the first day of the week. I can't give that to you because I can't defend that. I've never been able to defend that. So for me, if I can't defend it in a debate, I tend to go, well, I appreciate those that have that perspective, but I can't go that far because I would have to adopt different forms of hermeneutics and exegesis to be able to do that. So
gotcha.
I found years ago when I first started dealing, especially with Seventh-day Adventists, I had a bunch of Seventh-day Adventists in my family, I found a book called From Sabbath to Lord's Day to have some, I didn't agree with everything in it, but there, especially the historical stuff was really, really useful. I'm not even sure if it's in print anymore, but it's probably available, used or something like that from Amazon. It might be, I don't know, I haven't looked at it for years, but the historical material, especially on Kriya K. Himera, that wasn't Beckwith. Who was it that, I forget who, there was one particular chapter on the patristic utilization of Kriya K. Himera and the identification of that, that was particularly compelling when I was in Bible college. So that shows you how long ago it was. It is written in Sanskrit, so yeah, you'll have to do some translation of that. That's a joke, but anyway.
I'm sorry. Breaking up.
Okay.
Thank you so much for your time, Dr. White.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Emery. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bluetooth destroys humor. That's just... That's just dollars to. Okay, Corbin in Florida. Hi, Corbin.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me? Okay, I'm off the headset now.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I'm somebody who is aspiring to be a pastor one day and have had elders in my church affirm that, and I want to be an effective counselor. I know that you have obviously been an elder for years and was a hospital chaplain, and you've dealt with a lot of different people. And, I mean, I fundamentally believe in biblical counseling. And I have some friends who, I have a friend who's a psychologist, and we were having a conversation basically about integrating certain principles from psychology, not necessarily like Freudian kind of principles, but maybe like cognitive belief or something. I don't know. It's not important. But I didn't know if in your experience, if you ever gleaned any value from modern psychology, or if it's largely unuseful and really in practice, maybe a denial of the sufficiency that we have in Scripture.
Yeah, you know, this is one area that's about as in my wheelhouse as eschatology is. I really hesitate to address anything in it because I just don't do any reading in it. I can give you personal feelings and predilections, and the fact that it does seem to me that there's a tremendous amount of abandonment of biblical anthropology, but since I don't read in the area, it's not a subject that that I have any comfort addressing. There are lots of people who do from solid perspectives, I would guess, but it's just not my thing, and you'd have to inquire of them for resources and information on it. It's just, I'm very upfront about the things that are not a part of my area of study, and that's definitely one of them.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
All right. I apologize for that, but that's I can address certain things with some felicity, but that's one that's too complicated to get into without stepping on all sorts of landmines. So, all righty.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Yep. Thank you.
All right. God bless. Bye bye. All right. Let's talk to Kevin in Colorado. Hi, Kevin.
Hey there, James. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I have an older brother who is a quite liberal Christian, and he happened to be going to, he was in San Diego, I believe, this last week, and went to some sort of forum on church practice, modern church stuff, and he is definitely so liberal that he kind of follows some interesting characters, and he shared a pastor that his name is Randy Woodley.
Okay.
And it looks like a YouTube video. When I looked him up, I was immediately unsurprised by what I found. And the title of the video is Learning from Indigenous Peoples and Ethnic Diversity, the Global Church Project.
Oh, okay.
And he's, I believe he's part Native American. And long story short, most of what my brother touts is a lot of social justice warrior Christian wokeness,
okay,
for lack of a better term. So just was wondering if you had heard about them or that movement in general.
Well, not that specific individual, no. And
okay. You've got a few books out there, I guess.
Well, yes, so is everybody these days. But
right.
Yeah, I was directed to an upcoming, what was it, Freeing Evangelicalism from White Centeredness, I think.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of how they talk.
Yeah. And, you know, I scanned through the speakers, and this was being promoted, I think, by Anthony Bradley at King's College, graduate of Westminster Theological Seminary. It was either him or one of the group of Thabiti Anyabwili, Jamar Tisby, Kyle J. Howard, that group of folks. Somebody there was mentioning this upcoming and linking to this upcoming thing. And upon looking through the speakers, it was filled with people like what you just mentioned. Even more so, it was filled with at least one board member of Matthew Vine's group. The Reformation Project. So again, the woke train has many cars in it, and they're all connected together. Whether you want them there or not, they're once you open the door to the first car of the woke train, the rest is coming with it, and you can't get the door closed again because there's no place to close it. That is the issue. Yeah. Yeah. But indigenous theology. Yeah. Sorry. But, you know, I may love Navajo, jewelry. But that doesn't mean that I find the indigenous religions of, the American Indian population, which were primarily focused upon nature, animism, and things like that, to be something that I want to sort of bring into. And I'll never forget years ago. Were you thinking about? Yeah, Rich was thinking about the same thing. I was asked to run a TV camera. When I was much younger, I ran TV camera at a local large Southern Baptist church, and I was pretty good at it, so I actually could do it professionally. And I was hired as a part of a group to run camera at the who was it? The Anglicans? The Episcopalians? I think it was the Episcopalians. It was the Episcopalians had a convention here in Phoenix, and we were shooting, practicing the beginning of it, and they had these people praying at the four points of the compass, including praying for your children, gay and straight, and all the rest of that stuff. And then they had an Indian medicine doctor come in and do an Indian medicine dance as part of the opening prayers. And I remember, you know, if you've seen television guys, they've got these headsets and they have little microphones on them. So you've got a thing on your intercom. Yep. Yeah, you got your intercom on the belt. And so I sort of leaned into my camera and I clicked the intercom and I said, "Okay, guys, when the roof falls in, I'm diving under my camera." So. But yeah, the left is real big into this. Hey, let's just let all the other religions in here and let's not worry about that. So, yeah.
Yeah, I saw about a 20-minute little interview, I think it was for that seminar you just mentioned, and he started talking about life and the earth and how we treat it, and it was basically kind of moving from worshiping the creator to the created, and was talking about presence and even the peoples of the past, their presence is here. And all, I mean, it was just like so crazy, and he's still a reverend, so it was just pretty wild.
There's a lot of that type of stuff out there. It's just coming into circles we never expected it to. Thanks, Kevin. Oh, hey, by the way, I'm really sorry about the fact, since you live in Colorado, that your vote doesn't count anymore. I'm very sorry about that.
Yeah, I'm pretty ticked.
Yeah. But hey, you know, there you go. That's what happens when you elect the people you have in your governor's mansion and in the legislature.
That's right. We're going to regret it in 2 years.
Yep, sure are. All right. Thanks, man.
Yep. Have a good one. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. Hey, I was going to talk about this, and give me just this will make it a jumbo if that's all right. I hadn't talked about this. Some of the stuff that is appearing in social media is stunning. Everything that we're dealing with the left spinning language politically in Western culture, we're now dealing with within the church by people who have degrees from Reformed seminaries. You have people like Dr. Eric Mason in conversation with Dr. Anthony Bradley. Go back and find some of Dr. Bradley's old stuff from a decade ago. You will not recognize him as the same person he is today. I would say the same thing about Thabiti Anyabwili. And I was informed this week from someone, who I will not name because I don't want to get him in trouble, but actually found himself speaking in a church where Kyle J. Howard had been a member in years gone by. And the people there confirm that you wouldn't recognize the Kyle J. Howard of a decade ago with the Kyle J. Howard of today. And there are YouTube videos of Anthony Bradley basically saying what we are saying today, 10 years ago. He's not saying that now. And there, of course, there are videos of Thibodeau and Wheatley the same way. I can't say, I don't know about Eric Mason. But when you have Dr. Eric Mason saying things like, I have given up on evangelicalism, period. The construct is a facade. Your comments on the multi-ethnic church have validity. We lost all but a few whites. The freer I became as a black man. We are now a black church with the African diaspora. And then you have Anthony Bradley, and this was the 13th, so let's say the 21st, so 8 days ago. Just one, there were a number of them. So until white evangelicalism partners with the National Black Evangelical Association, etc., it's hard to believe that other agendas aren't the real agenda. Like lining up a bunch of Oreos at your seminary, or Oreos planting churches for your denominations for the optics, etc. And this included, at one point, the posting of a graphic of an Oreo, which, as you know, is black on the outside and white on the inside. I find this incredibly sad. It's hypocritical to a level that's stunning. If anyone used that same kind of language in reverse, they would be said to be founding a new order of the KKK. But it's okay, because there are now many people who do not believe that a black person or a black Christian can be a racist, because they've accepted the redefinition of the word into something that precludes it from being a sin. It's funny. On the one side, they'll want to use the term racism as a sin and then redefine it to where blacks can't do it, as if blacks are precluded from certain kinds of sin by their ethnic heritage. It is grossly offensive to call someone an Oreo. That requires you to read hearts. It requires you to be the standard definer of what it means to be black. But you'll notice this: all this language. I became as a black man, not as a Christian man. It's a black man. Oreo. It's all about black man, not Christian man. The priorities are upside down. It's not Christian first, it's ethnicity first, and then Christian later. That's what this is. How can you not see this? And yet, when you point it out, you know who the first people are to rush in and start redefining the terms in defense? Whites. White liberals. Because this is absolutely definitional of the narrative that they're trying to promote. And so, I was just stunned, and I keep using it. I'm using the term stunned too much. I must be just walking around constantly stunned because of what's going on, how fast it's happening, and how hypocritical it is. And how someone who could think so clearly 10 years ago, 10 years later, is calling people Oreos and saying, cool. Posting links to conferences with folks from Matthew Vine's group speaking there. Cool. What happened? It really is an amazing thing. Lining up a bunch of Oreos at your seminary, or Oreos planting churches for your denomination for the optics. Wow. There is animus in those words. If you can't see the animus in those words, your lenses are so thick that you're not even, yeah. Should I say anything about the debate? I didn't say anything about the debate. Let me just briefly. Okay. I hadn't even seen that. Okay. So you were saying the same thing. Look, I am really sick of drama on this. I have one reason for addressing. I've still got my Greek New Testaments sitting over here. I have one reason for addressing the textual traditionalism amongst Reform folks. And it is, as I have said, I am deeply concerned that the acceptance of textual traditionalism, ecclesiastical textism, TR-onlyism, whatever it might be, I have more respect for ecclesiastical textism than I do TR-onlyism. And both those are different than Byzantine priority. These are not the same things. If you think they're the same things, you don't know what you are talking about. I'm serious. And there's nothing wrong to not, if you're sitting there going, well, I don't know what they are, you're a meanie. No. If you don't know what the difference between those things are, fine. But if you are promoting these things and going on Facebook and saying, I'm perverting scripture or denying the preservation of scripture, and you don't know the difference of them, shame on you. Shame on you. Because you don't know what you're talking about. You have not done your homework. Anyway, on this program 2 days ago, what had happened, again, very clearly, very briefly, I had been accused of denying the preservation of Scripture, which is just simply untrue. The proper accusation would be, you don't accept the same mechanism of preservation as this little group over here does, which is way out of the mainstream of scholarship, even in Reformed circles. I mean, you can't go to RTS or Westminster or places like that and find their perspective predominating. It doesn't. It's a minority view. The only argument we've been is, you're not a part of this minority view. Yep, that's right. Long history of having been real clear on that. So I had responded to this. Colin Pearson had gotten involved, and I think Robert Truelove had gotten involved. And I had been directed to, and I had seen a link to Jeffrey Riddle responding to some stuff that I said about Revelation 16:5, and I had downloaded the file. Long story short, right as I'm about to come to the office, I see an announcement, I think it was from Robert Truelove, saying that they were going to have a conference, text and canon, in late October, in where? Atlanta, Georgia. Now, why does so much stuff happen in Atlanta, Georgia? Because it's easy to get there. There are all sorts of locations, all sorts of churches. It's easy to get to. Atlanta is a big airport. It's a hub for many, many, many of the airlines. Now, some of you may not travel. I never thought I would be a traveler. But I'm executive platinum, one world emerald. That's top end. That's over 100,000 miles in the air every year. I know Heathrow, especially Terminal 5, but Terminal 3, like the back of my hand. There's a great Italian restaurant in Terminal 3. Spaghetti Bolognese. It's wonderful. They just don't start serving it till too late in the day. Anyways, so you can get in and out of Atlanta so easily. It's nice having G3 there. I mean, getting to G3 is simple. It's so easy. So the point is, I saw that and I'm like, hey, I've got an idea. Everybody has been saying you need to debate Jeff Riddle. You need to debate this. You need to quit hiding behind the dividing line. Blah, 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 blah. It's been being said for years. Okay. I'm working on a PhD in this field. So doing debates that would be relevant to that field would be great. And it just so happens that at the very same time, I'm seeing other messages about another possibility in a different area, Islam, about doing some debates the next weekend in London. And I go, oh, okay. When we went to G3, I went straight from G3. Well, okay, straight from G3. I went from Atlanta to Heathrow to... Okay, Moscow. Well, didn't I go... What about Munich? Well, I know I went to Moscow.
Moscow, then Tamara, then Tamara back to Moscow, then Moscow to London, and then London...
No, you. Okay, so how did I end up in Munich twice? You skipped Munich both times. I had to go through Munich to get to Moscow.
Okay, so let me explain this. You went from Atlanta to London to Moscow to Samara, Samara to Moscow, Moscow to London, London to Munich, Munich to Munster. Munster was supposed to go to Frankfurt, got canceled, so you wound up back at Munich and then at London and then back to Phoenix.
Running through.
This, folks, is how James travels.
Alone.
And you know how James travels this way?
Alone.
Alone. I make it happen.
That's right.
And when he's taking puddle jumpers to small cities, I'm no insult intended to anybody, but it's my job to maximize the amount of time and travel to get to places. If he goes to Atlanta and then comes back to Phoenix and then turns around and flies to London from Phoenix a week later or 2 weeks later, and then back to Phoenix, and then back to London again.
Waste of time and money.
It's me. It's crazy, and there's nothing left of him, and he's never here to do this show. See, that's the thing.
So, the point is that I go, hey, this could work. Let's make this happen. Atlanta, perfect. I can go from there to the next thing. We can make it one big trip. It'll fit at that time period after I do Australia. Let's do it. Well, my invitation was declined. And basically all I've been told is it doesn't fit our conference. We don't want this at our conference. Oh, okay. And there's another church in Boone's Mill, Virginia, that had contacted us, but the guys there, in talking with Rich, had said this would be the first time they've done something like this, right? That's not as easy to get to as Atlanta, okay? You've got to do some hopping around, and to get back out, you got to do some hopping around, and we're talking about basically over a year, 14 months from now. Now, if that's all we can do, you know, we'll try to work with the church to make sure that we've got the right recording equipment and stuff like that. It will complicate things, and it won't go. I mean, we offered no cost to their conference at all. We take care of all that on our own. Yes.
For what it's worth, I actually offered that if it was a problem for Dr. Riddle and for Pastor Truelove, I told this to him last night in private, but I'll make it public. I offered to, if the cost of an extra night for them to be there, we will cover the hotel room for them.
Sure, it's not a problem. It just seemed like a good way of getting this done. And my focus, of course, is on Reformed Baptists, because what's happened is that as a result, these other people from different perspectives with, you know, there's all these folks that just desperately want their 15 minutes of fame, even though they've got completely idiosyncratic perspectives that are just way out in Loopville. They want to do their thing, or they want to argue something other than what we're actually arguing here, which is a theological concept of the meaning of preservation and the mechanism of preservation amongst Reformed people who have a very high view of Scripture. And I'm just sort of like, no, thanks, I understand. So, as it stands right now, we don't think that anything's going to be happening in October, though I'd like to see that happen. And if we just have to do it 14 months down the road, I mean, I don't know what's going to be going on 14 months down the road. It's a long time in the future, but whatever. Made the offer. We've been very, very clear about what our purposes and intentions are. And there's been all this drama. You know, why did you do it this way or that way? It's like, oh, please. I saw the announcement. It said, hey, this would be a great way to do it. And then there's all these folks going, well, they offered to do a written thing. Already did the written thing. And we did it with Doug Wilson, and neither one of us were satisfied with it at all. The fact of the matter is, live cross-examination, is absolutely different than any type of other encounter. It just is. Anybody, if you want to disagree with that, fine. I don't care. I think it's self-evident, but I don't care. I'm not interested in the drama. Just not interested in the drama. We've put it out there. If they want to do it, great. If they want to wait for 14 months, we'll do our best to come up with what be useful for the widest number of people as possible. Fine. I just don't want the drama. We have far more important things to be doing. Really, really do. The whole reason I address this is because I think it takes really important people out of the battle. But hey, if you did, you forget to bring up the Rich Cam while you were talking? Oh, okay. I didn't see. I was just looking over and somebody mentioned something about it. So yeah. Oh, okay. All right.
Hello.
All right.
How are you doing?
Yeah. Okay.
So
someone was saying that Clementine is just beautiful. Yeah, yes. She is. All our girls are beautiful. Cadence and Jenny and Clementine, they're all special. So I'm a proud grandpa, and love all the kids. And Waylon's a boy's boy. Let me tell you something. You seen that video? The difference. This is why women live longer, have longer life expectancy. Is the little girl comes down, she gently gets off of the slide, and then right at the end, you see this boy coming head first and flipping off and landing. That's Waylon coming. That's Waylon coming down the slide. Big time. Big time. no two ways about it. So anyway, all right. So not sure what next week's going to look like. We'll try to get two programs in, but like I said, I leave Thursday. And so that sort of takes up the end of the week, and we'll just see what the schedule looks like. But Lord willing, we'll at least get two programs in next week. Thanks for listening to this one. We'll see you next time. God bless.